Zorba Pastor on your health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you'd like to talk with Zorba, you'll call 800-462-7413. And along with your calls, some interesting research, Zorba.
Yes, we're going to talk about lefties. And are they at risk for earlier death than righties?
Oh, my goodness. Maybe bad news for left-handers.
Bad news for lefties. Get new genes and you'll be just fine.
What else?
We're going to talk about OxyContin and the fine that Purdue Pharma got and a bunch of executives and what that means really to the pharmaceutical industry.
That was really bad news for the people there.
Big fine, big problems. Public beware, doctors beware.
What's our recipe?
Apple curry chicken.
Looking forward to that.
It's wonderful. Tasty, delicious, a good way to have your chicken. Have you had your chicken today?
And we have a medical myth buster coming up later in the hour. Lots of good reasons for you to stay with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. A listener now, Zorba, in Valley Stream, New York. Hi.
Yeah, how are you? It's John. Here's my question.
We're fine, by the way.
Good.
How are you?
Good.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
When I was 17 years old, I sustained an injury to my eye. I was struck by a branch. My specific question, though, is I would like to avoid having to go, when I get older, for cataract surgery. So what I would like to know is, what can you do specifically to prevent the formation of cataracts? Dietary, or are there any type of special nutrients that can dissolve cataracts so I can avoid having to go through cataract surgery? And does that analysis apply equally to age-related cataracts as to traumatically induced cataracts?
Right. Now, why just for a minute, why are you worried about cataract surgery? Or the side effects? What bothers you about it?
I would like to avoid going through surgery, period.
Sure.
Taking steps to avoid open-heart surgery, through my diet, and I'd like to avoid cataract surgery. If there's something out there that I can use to eliminate the cataract.
Oh, you bet.
Now, I've heard some strange literature that they have something in Russia that can dissipate cataracts. Then I've also heard that there's a dietary analysis to cataracts, that if you eat better, there's a lower incidence of cataract formation. I went to my ophthalmologist, who's pretty well known in this region, and I said to him, can I do anything to minimize this? He said, there's nothing. But then he said, wear sunglasses.
Right.
He's doing cataract surgery, this guy.
But getting back to that, that actually is a biggie. The sunglass issue is actually a biggie with cataracts. If we look at the risk factors that there are for cataracts, there's certain drugs that can produce it and make it more likely to happen. Steroids, prednisone, a drug that's used for people who have an autoimmune disease such as lupus or asthma and so on. We know that steroids can cause cataracts as well as other medications. So what you want to do is avoid medications that can cause cataracts. And the way you do it is if you have a prescription drug, you ask the pharmacist or you look it up and you say to the pharmacist or the doctor, does this increase the risk of cataracts? That's one way to do it. Avoid those drugs, as I said, like steroids. Second thing is we know, for instance, that sunglasses really do make a difference. We know that irradiation to the eye in the form of sun increases the risk of cataracts. People, for instance, who live in Tibet have a very, very high rate of cataracts. People who live in Peru at about 10 and 12,000 feet because they have more radiation in the eye are at a higher risk for actually developing cataracts. So avoiding the sun does make a difference. Dietary, nothing that we know of. Is there something out there? Well, maybe there's something out there, but we have not yet figured out what it is in the diet. It's not a lack of vitamin A or a lack of, which a lot of people thought for a while, but it's not the case. It's not a lack of B vitamins, so there's no dietary thing. The Russian scam to dissolve cataracts is a Russian scam to dissolve cataracts. There's no drug that does it. It's outside of tonsillitis, cataracts are really the most common surgical procedure. And in the right hands, they are extremely effective and well done. But I understand, what you're worried about. You had trauma to your eye, and that means the inside of your eye, the mechanical inside of your eye, probably is not normal. There's probably some variation of normal there, which would make you at higher risk if you have cataract surgery.
But have you heard, though, that there's a diet? If you're eating very healthy foods, more vegetarian, organic, diet, that you have a lower incidence of cataract formation than if you're eating junk food and smoking cigarettes?
No, I don't think so. I don't think I've ever read anything like that. Now, if you eat really healthy, you actually have a higher incidence of cataracts because you're going to live longer. You know, you eat that junk food, you won't get cataracts before you die because you'll die
you'll
sooner.
Die. Yeah.
So from that point of view, I guess there is a dietary relationship with the development of cataract. But I've never read anything about it that a low cholesterol, low fat, vegan type diet is actually going to make a difference in cataracts. No, I don't think so.
Is that right?
No. But I think sunglasses make a difference. That data.
Thanks a lot for the call. On the cataract thing, Zorba, people I've known who have had cataract surgery are really, really happy.
Absolutely,
with it.
Absolutely. And
to underline the point you were making, I mean, that's a pretty effective surgery usually. Not that anybody would want to have it.
By the time you often get cataract surgery, your vision has become cloudier, the colors have not been as vibrant, and people often say...
It comes right back.
You bet. Well, what happens is the retina, which doesn't get as much light, immediately gets lots of light. You can see what you're looking at, and it makes life much better.
Mm. Now, let's get to the left-handed problem here. A shorter life for left-handers?
That's right. I'm sorry, lefties. If you're women, that's about it. You're just going to have a shorter lifespan, at least according to this. Well, it's an interesting article. There have been a number of articles intermittently about left-handed men and left-handed women. There have been articles that show that lefties are more intelligent than righties, that lefties are much more likely to be able to do math and computer science and to basically go into... Are you left-handed yourself?
No, I'm right-handed. I believe this totally
They're much more likely to go into high-paying technical jobs, and right-handed people are much more likely to go into journalism and mass media and undoubtedly public radio and authoring. But this looked at left-handed women, and it looked at data of left-handed women over a period of time. They looked at about 12,000 Dutch women. So this is Holland, Dutch women, right?
Okay.
How applicable is this to American women? I don't know. But if you live in Holland, you know, they had 12,000 women, followed them for about 12, 13 years. 250 of them died. Looked who was left-handed, who was right-handed. Lo and behold, the lefties had a 40% higher risk of dying from any cause, a 70% higher risk from dying of cancer.
70%.
And a 30% higher risk of dying from stroke and heart attack.
My goodness.
And the question is this genetic, environmental, or is this hokum? Is this just it's 12,000 women. It's an observational study.
Well,
so
it says here they hypothesize that left-handedness is the result of an insult suffered during prenatal life, which ultimately leads to the early death.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't know if I buy that. You know, I mean, this is all, you know, we don't know what causes some people to be left-handed and some people to be right-handed. And also, what do you do about it? I mean, we like to be able to do something. You can't change your left-handedness or right-handedness. But it is fascinating because if this bears out in other studies, it means that women, and this was a women's study, it means that women who are left-handed have to be screened more for cancer and heart disease. It doesn't mean that they're all of a sudden going to die. But it means it's another risk factor, just like a genetic risk factor. Your mom had breast cancer, or your dad had heart attack, or so on, or somebody had colon cancer. Left-handedness may be a risk factor, which means you have to be more intense in your screening.
Just like a lot of things, there are both sides of the coin. There's the good and the bad. Lefties are smarter.
That's right. They're smarter.
But
they're
definitely more intelligent. They die sooner.
Okay. Take your chances, you know.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. On we go, Zorba, to Logansport, Indiana. Hi.
Greetings from Indiana.
Yes, how can we help you?
I have a question. I am asthmatic, and it's been pretty well controlled with medication and avoiding my triggers, which primarily are perfumes and scents. My problem is I moved to a different office building about 4 or 5 weeks ago, and ever since then I have had continued problems, which culminated in a severe asthma attack. Afterwards, some of the people that worked there had told me that they've suspected for quite a while that there's been something wrong with this building, meaning mold or moisture. My question is, what are the detrimental side effects for someone who's in that type of environment, And also, what are the best ways to clean that up?
Well, mold is an interesting stuff. Molds are all around us. I mean, we've lived with them, you know, since we developed as humans. And, you know, what disease they actually cause is really open to question. You know, we look at mold now and we say that's the cause of it. And there's a lot of controversy because the fact is there is something called sick building syndrome where there are new buildings and people get sick and we don't know what they're from. The leading proponent and theory is really they're from chemicals that are in the air that are actually making us sick. The chemicals that are basically, you know, when you smell that new building, like that new car smell, that these chemicals affect people in an adverse way. And that's the present theory. And the present scientific theory is that mold is very secondary. Now, the issue is that mold then has become a public health concern. And so as soon as we find mold, we say, oh, the mold did it. You know, the mold is responsible for it, when in fact the science behind that is really pretty shaky. And I'm not saying the mold isn't part of it, but the science behind it is kind of shaky, and there's a lot of hysteria. The hysteria is not shaky. The hysteria is there. People see mold on the wall, and they go, that's why I have fatigue, and that's why I'm tired, because there's mold on the wall. So I want to bring it back from there in that we don't know what effect mold has. You know, you take areas in the country, such as the South, New Orleans, where they clearly have more mold than in the North, and it's not as if we see more disease from that mold, which is what you would expect. You'd expect moldy areas of the country in the deep South would have certain diseases more commonly than in the upper North, and they're not that way. So how do you clean up the mold? What you do is you go to an environmental specialist who knows how to clean up the mold. That's what you do. And clearly, the way you clean up the mold is a matter of ventilation and air. I mean, because mold thrives in a dark, you know, in a dark environment where there's no air circulation. So you've got to get air circulation to that area. How you do it and what else you do with it to basically get the mold out of there, that's an environmental issue. That I clearly don't know what that is, but I know who I'd call. I'd call an environmental, you know, specialist. Now, when you go back to your desk, remember, this is an airborne issue. You need ventilation. Ultimately, that's what you need to have. Simple way of adding ventilation to your desk is with a fan. That's a very simple way. It doesn't change the entire room, but it moves the air around and things are much less likely to settle there. So a little portable fan or a hand fan will make a difference in your immediate environmental area. Some people say it stirs up the dust. I don't believe that unless you've got a lot of dust on your desk, in which case it will do that. So, but that's what I would do. I would stay away from it when they're doing it. They've got to have environmental safety. But once again, I just mentioned, we don't know what these molds do. We know dust is a problem with people. They sneeze and they get upset and buildings are a problem, but I want to be the devil's advocate on the mold. And and whenever we talk about mold, I get a gazillion emails on mold from the pro anti mold contingent, which voices itself very strongly right now.
Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. Speaking of workplace conditions, Zorba, let's see if we can help out Betsy in Sister Bay, Wisconsin. This is a good one. Betsy's husband.
These are bad ones?
See what you do with this. Betsy's husband worked in a foundry for his whole career, and ever since he's retired, he's been craving salty foods. This didn't seem too strange until Betsy noticed all of his old work buddies looking for their salt fixes as well. Question: did a lifelong job in the foundry leave them itching for more salt?
Oh, my gosh. That's a very interesting, I mean, talk about an interesting question. So you work in a foundry and you eat salty foods. Well, I'll tell you what I think. Often, people who work in blue-collar jobs eat prepackaged foods that may have more salt in it and may have more fat in it. So it may just be, it's the environment, maybe the other people around you who ate salty foods, and that sort of became your habit. But you look at Americans, they all eat salty foods. I mean, they all eat salty foods. You look at it, you go look at a vending machine in any building in America short of Whole Foods, and what you will see is it's filled with salty foods and sweet foods. What else is in there? An apple? They always have a row of apples, you know, for the those. And if you look at the vending machines like I do in hospitals, you know, in the middle of the night when there's when you want to get something, the apples are the only things
everything
that are left.
Gone except the apples.
They just gone. The apples are there. Oh, I can have an apple. You know, when you want something salty or something sweet, salty snacks are a big business in America. It's not just the foundry. Everybody wants salty foods. I mean, that's pretzels, you know, potato chips, you know, I mean, Cheetos, you know, all that stuff.
Except you. You're a famous radio health doctor. You don't eat
any. Salty foods never touch my lips. Sweet foods never touch my lips. I am perfect. Moi is perfect. I have never even thought of an Oreo, let alone a potato chip. Not me.
Well, we like hearing from you. Keep your questions, tips, and comments coming. Just send them in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number, and a St. Louis, Missouri listener joins us now. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, what's up?
Well, I have some pain in my left foot, and I guess last November I was diagnosed with diabetes, so I start to pay more attention to things, and it's diet-controlled, and the A1C levels are between 6.3 and 6.5, so I don't think it's diabetic-related.
Okay, so now, let me explain that to people who not knowledgeable. We have a measurement called the hemoglobin A1C. It's also called glycosylated hemoglobin, and it measures overall what your blood sugar is over the last 90 days, roughly. So the if you're a diabetic, that hemoglobin A1C is elevated, generally above 7. It can be as high as 12, or I've seen it as high as 16. It's a high number. If you're not a diabetic, it's below 7, basically. That's what it is. And the lower it is, sort of the better off you are. Most people who are healthy and active, have an active lifestyle, have about 5.6 is a pretty common number. So your hemoglobin A1C was normal?
Correct. Correct.
And your fasting blood sugar was?
About 95.
Okay.
I check
and
my sugar
below 100
every day,
is definitely normal. Please, continue.
But so now, as a result of that, you know, I went through the little training class. I pay more attention to my feet. Well, I have a pain in my left foot, and it's kind of nondescript. It's a sharp pain, and it's between or in my third or fourth toe, the two next to the pinky toe. And I would talk to my doctor about it in one of my checkups, and he suspected a Morton's neuroma.
Right, Morton's neuroma, which is a little nerve. Well, it's a nerve, and it's a swelling of the nerve that often occurs between the second and third or the third and fourth digits in the feet. Right.
And he said, well, you just need to get some inserts, go see a podiatrist, and you'll be fine. Then when I did some research, it said, you know, some burning pain in the ball of your foot, and I have none of that. Like when I go down steps, like when I flex my foot forward, when my toes are flexed, it hurts the most. So like very often I'll find myself walking and I'll curl my toes when I walk, and that seems to help it. And I just wanted to find out if there's anything other than inserts or there's some exercises I can do or what can I do to help that.
Well, you can go. The way you treat a Morton's neuroma when it bothers you, and if you're curling your feet when you're walking, I definitely would call that something bothering you if you change the way you walk, is to basically get surgery. What the surgery is it's really very simple. They take out the nerve. They basically go in there, find the nerve, and take the nerve out. They cut it so that it no longer affects it. And it's surprisingly effective. If you couldn't do that in your fingers or your hands because you need to have all the sensation in your fingers, but in your feet, it doesn't cause, when people have it, they feel much better. The little bit of numbness that's then present on the toe doesn't seem to bother people. Think about your toes. I mean, you don't really pay attention to the third and fourth toe. Right. As much as you do to the ring finger and the pinky finger. And so what I would do is you can have, number one, an injection. Some people, an injection of a steroid into the area by a podiatrist or a physician will work out really well. If that doesn't work, have the nerve actually taken out. And that's far better than wearing inserts. But sometimes inserts will work in the short run. Some people just gets it to settle down. And you need a shoe with a wide shoe box. As you're walking, you want your toes to be able to fan out. So I would recommend not wearing those 3-inch spiked heels. Because that'll make it worse. And it is much more common in women who wear high heels than men. So good luck.
Thanks for the call. Our recipe coming up, a good one too.
It's
apple
great.
Curry chicken. Lots more of your calls, some more research coming up, our medical myth buster. All of that right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Glad to have you along. You'll want to listen carefully because this is a great recipe coming up for apple curry chicken.
Apple curry chicken. Think about it. You've got boneless, skinless chicken breasts that you can use that are healthy, a healthy source of protein. You've got apples. You remember, an apple a day keeps who away? Anybody?
You.
Anybody? Right. Right. You eat apples, and I promise you I will not show up at your house. And curry has turmeric that may give you a long, healthy life and may reduce the risk of colon cancer. Yeah. There's some people who believe that.
Adam Friedrich, our program producer, has fixed it for us, and
it smells
delicious.
It smells so
good. Let's rush
good.
Through the ingredients so that I may eat
down.
Some.
So yeah. Wolf it down.
Right.
I start out with 1 1/4 pounds of chicken breasts, boneless and skinless.
A pound and a quarter of chicken breasts, boneless and skinless.
That's right. And that feeds 4 people. I mean, you know, pound and a quarter is what we're going to use here approximately.
Okay.
3 tablespoonfuls of flour.
3 big tea flour.
That's right. And for something like this, I often use Wondra. Wondra, W-O-N-D-R-A, is a type of flour that I like because it smooths out easier when you're actually using it. It's mm-hmm. in a little sort of container. It's milled in a totally different way. And that's what I use for stuff like this.
Okay.
A tablespoonful of olive oil.
1 big tea olive oil.
1 onion peeled and chopped.
An onion peeled and chopped.
That's right. You can either use a red or a white, depending on how you want this to look.
Mm-hmm.
A tablespoonful of water.
A big tea, water.
Okay, now we come to our apple. Peeled, cored, and chopped.
Okay. Peel, core, and chop
That's
an
right.
apple.
Right, and that takes a bit of work. If you want it to be tartar, use a Granny Smith. If you want it to be sweeter, then maybe use Aroma, something like that. But the apple of your choice.
Okay.
A cup of fat-free chicken broth. If you don't have the fat-free, well, it'll have a little more fat in there, but try to get the fat-free
cup
or low-fat.
Cup of chicken broth, fat-free.
And now we have our spice. 1/2 teaspoon salt.
1/2 tea salt.
1/4 teaspoon curry powder.
1/4 little tea curry powder.
1/8 teaspoon ground ginger.
An 1/8 of a little tea ground ginger.
That's right. 1/8 teaspoon ground turmeric.
An 1/8 of a little tea ground turmeric.
1/8 teaspoon ground black pepper.
An 1/8 of a little tea ground black pepper.
And 1/3 of a cup of raisins.
And some raisins.
Now, looking at variations of this, mm-hmm. instead of using the 1/8 teaspoon ground ginger, if you want it to be brighter, use grated ginger. And I take my grated ginger, I put it in the freezer, and I grate it directly from the freezer because it has a much more vibrant taste, a smell and a taste to it. And for raisins, if you want to use black raisins, it'll be darker. If you use golden raisins, it will be lighter.
Adam has black raisins.
So here's how we do it. Preheat the oven at 350. Now rinse the chicken breasts, pat them dry, and roll them in the flour that you're using. Heat the oil in a large skillet over medium heat. Add chicken and brown on both sides. It's about 4 minutes or so, 4 to 5 minutes on each side. But you're going to brown it, then set it aside in a baking dish.
Mm-hmm.
Now in the same skillet over medium heat, you know, there will be what's called frond, which is the dry stuff that sticks to the bottom of the skillet that really has the taste to it. You don't want to get rid of that frond. You take that, but you don't want it to burn either, and you take a spatula and you mix up that, you know, the frond, which is the stuff in the bottom of it, and then cook an onion in water for about 5 minutes, add the apple, cook about a minute longer, and then spoon that over the chicken. Okay, spooned over the chicken. Mm-hmm. Now, in a small bowl, combine the chicken broth, the salt, the curry, the ginger, the turmeric, the pepper. So you got all your spices and mm-hmm. liquid.
Mm-hmm.
Pour it over the chicken. Bake this now for 40 minutes in the oven. In the last 5 minutes, add the raisins. If you add them sooner, what will happen is they will smush down. That's mm-hmm. a technical term, smush.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the last 5 minutes until done, serve it hot and bon appetit.
This is 180
delicious. Calories, low fat, 0.65, 4 grams of fat, very little saturated fat. It's really good. It's got a lot of protein in it, too. It's got 24% of the protein you need, so
this
it's
is,
really good.
This is just delicious. This is one of our better recipes ever. Zorba, you
this is great.
Outdone yourself. And Adam is just the perfect chef here. On this.
Well, Adam is getting married soon, so he'll be... I think it's, you know what they say, a way to a woman's heart is through her stomach.
Well, she's right?
She's
got a good catch in Adam. She'll have a cook for the rest of her life. Anyway, it's delicious, and you'll want to get a copy of this recipe and cook it up yourself, or better still, have your partner cook it up for you. Address your request to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin. Our zip is 53706. Be sure to include a stamped, self-addressed, business-sized envelope so we can send it back to you.
Or come to our website at zorbapastor.org. You can pull down that recipe, and you can sign up for our free podcast and get the recipe of the week.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is in Edmond, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. Hi, Tom.
How can we help?
Well, I'm just getting over pneumonia, which I guess I've had for 7 weeks now. I'm beginning to feel better, but I have a couple of questions. One is, how soon do you think until I can get back to a rigorous program of exercise? I'm a runner and a bike rider. And also, what can I do to avoid contracting pneumonia in the future?
Because yeah, no kidding.
It wasn't any walk in the park.
That's a long siege.
It's not
yeah.
a walk in the park.
I'm glad you're getting better.
Now, it took you a long time, 7 weeks, where there are some complicating factors. I assume you're not a smoker, correct?
Not a smoker and otherwise healthy. I don't think I've ever had pneumonia. It began as bronchitis, and I was busy at work, so I didn't take the time off that I should have to rest, and it just progressed and I guess got into pneumonia, and the rest is history.
Right. Well, and pneumonia throughout almost all the ages, from the age of around 25 on, certainly probably from the age of 15 on, pneumonia is always in the top 10 leading causes of death, regardless of the age group. And it can be a serious problem that quickly has to be addressed. And the quicker you address it, the better off you are. So the first thing you want to do is, A, if you get sick, you want to see your doctor, certainly in the next couple of years. And because you're more at risk for developing another pneumonia, that's at least what my thought is. Now, whether that's scientifically proven or not, I don't know. But when somebody has pneumonia, I tell people, come back at the first
well,
sign of a chest
infection. Well, next couple of years
infection.
Sounds like a long time. I mean,
what is a long time?
Wouldn't it
it's
be
the next couple of years.
Next 6 months or something?
No, I think for the next couple of years, you get a chest cold, you go see your doctor. To make sure you don't have a pneumonia. You get an evaluation for the next couple of years. Now, have you had the pneumonia shot called Pneumovax?
No, I haven't.
You need it.
Pneumonia
shot. You get it one time. It doesn't stop all forms of pneumonia, but it stops many of the most common forms of pneumonia. It is an immunization for pneumonia. It's very good. Everyone needs a one-time
shot.
Should
he be fully recovered before he gets that
shot? Not at all. You can do it anytime you want to.
Pneumovax. Okay.
Every year you ought to get an influenza shot, certainly for the next 5 to 10 years.
Okay.
And the reason is you're more likely to get influenza and more likely to get a complication from influenza. Those are the things.
Okay.
Now, what brought this on? Were you around little kids who got sick at all?
I'm not sure. I have a young son. He's almost six. And, of course, when he brings something home, I generally get it, and I'm worse than him.
Right.
But he didn't bring anything home that I'm aware of. He wasn't sick. It just developed as a chest cold that didn't go away.
That's it. I think because you're a healthy, exercising person, you just got the pneumonia, chances are it's not going to come back. But the real issue is for the next couple of years, you have a chest cold that doesn't go away right away, get checked again.
Okay.
And the reason is there's no good explanation, and sometimes there's something else that's occurring there, that may be part of this. A couple questions. Did you get a follow-up chest x-ray when it was done to make sure it totally cleared?
That's supposed to be this week. So
okay. That's very important, especially in an unanticipated pneumonia. It's important to get a follow-up chest x-ray to make sure that the pneumonia is fully cleared.
Now, he wanted to know when he can go back to his exercise regimen.
Whenever you feel like it. Basically,
okay.
You feel like it, you can do it. I tell people go back to one quarter of what they normally do. If they're heavy exercisers, if they really go for it, do a quarter of what you normally do for a few days. If that feels good, go to about half of what you do for a few days.
But you want to get that chest x-ray first, right?
No, I think you can do that anytime. I think you just need a chest x-ray to make it cleared. You base it on clinically how you feel. That's how you decide when you go back.
Okay, very good.
Good luck.
I appreciate that. Thanks for the advice.
Pleasure is ours.
Appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. A listener with us now in Spring Green, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Zorba and Tom. How are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
So I have swollen lymph nodes under my in my armpit, and I'm pregnant, and it's gotten worse since I've been pregnant. And I know that the lymph nodes also have to do with immunity. And so I'm just curious how concerned I should be. They are tender to the touch. and what I could do.
Now, how far along are you?
I am 7 months.
7 months. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. Do you know if it's a boy or a girl?
No idea.
No idea. Okay. Now, have you had swollen lymph nodes before?
Yes.
Okay, so you've had, in other words, this has been a lifelong problem or a problem since adolescence?
Yes.
Okay. Well, they're getting worse with pregnancy, which is what it is. Have you had antibiotics before for these lymph nodes?
No.
You know, I think, frankly, if you have a tendency toward these glands, especially under the armpit, getting larger and then getting smaller and getting larger and smaller, it's just a matter of keeping an eye on it to make sure that they don't develop into an infection. And if so, you know, you may need antibiotics, and then you have to make sure that they're antibiotics that are obviously safe for you and safe for the baby. Certain antibiotics that we often give for women and men who are not pregnant are tetracycline-based antibiotics called macrolides. You wouldn't have that, you know, if you were pregnant. That's one that you would avoid. So I think it's just a matter of mentioning to your doctor when you see it and just sort of keeping an eye on it. I don't think anything more than that. If they bother you, warm, moist compresses under the armpits can help relieve the pressure and the pain there. A little Tylenol is also safe for you and safe for the baby. Those are things that you can do. And that's kind of what I would do. I would just, you know, when you're pregnant, it's just a matter of observation and staying away from anything unless you have to, unless you're pushed into doing something.
Do you have boys and girls' names picked up?
No, we can't agree on anything. So we're just going with that. Wait till we meet the little one first.
Wow. Wait until we meet the little one. But it's 7 months. Let me tell you, I am sure that you're going to have more conversations between now and when that baby comes out as to what the names are.
Yeah, we like Haven.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's way cool. Way cool. Well, congratulations. Call us after the baby comes out and let us know if it's a boy or a girl.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call at 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's grab a quick question from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This one comes to us from Mike in Gladstone, Michigan. He writes, Dr. Zorba and Tom, I recently started listening to your recipe podcasts while I mow the lawn each week. However, I have to turn my MP3 player all the way up to hear you two laugh over the noise of the lawnmower. Question, am I hurting my ears by doing this? And is it worth it?
Well, so? I'll answer the second question first. Yes, it's worth it. There's no doubt about
going
it.
Going deaf? Going Zorba,
absolutely.
Listening to Zorba Pastor and your health is worth right. Maybe going
no, no.
deaf?
No, what he has to do is change his earphones. He can't use the little earbuds on your MP3 player. Yeah. What you have to do is you have to use earphones that cover the ears completely and keep away the noise. And then it's acceptable to do is what to do to do's to do. You want a noise reduction earphone put in your ear. You put music through a noise reduction earphone, and what it does is it cuts out the noise from the outside, protects your ear, and then you can listen to the podcast. And that makes it worth it.
Don't forget those weekly podcasts are available at our website, which is
ZorbaPastor.org.
And if you have a comment, question, or tip for us, send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have more coming up. Our medical myth buster. We have some interesting research. More of your calls, too, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413, the toll-free number if you'd like to talk with Zorba. Before our next call, though, Zorba, the makers of the painkiller OxyContin took a huge, huge financial hit not that long ago from the Justice Department, the biggest fine ever imposed on a drug maker, it says here.
Right. $634.5 million. Dollars. That's right. More than $500 million fined the company for OxyContin, stating that they totally had misrepresented the drug, that they represented that OxyContin was less addictive than other narcotic painkillers, and that they basically did this between 1996 and mid-2001. When OxyContin was really taking off, that they really tried to more or less encourage doctors to prescribe OxyContin in circumstances where they weren't, that it really was not a drug that patients were going to become habituated to, which is completely wrong. It's a very useful drug as a narcotic, but it is a narcotic.
And did you, as a practicing family doc, ever feel leaned on by the OxyContin people?
No, but we don't have drug salesmen that come into our office. We don't do that.
Oh.
In our particular office, we had the drug salesmen sort of not come in the office, threw them out, as we said, about 5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
For a whole bunch of reasons, we decided that we would make our own evaluation.
Yeah.
And I've used OxyContin, and I continue to use OxyContin and other drugs, but with all narcotics, you have to be careful how you use them. You have to monitor people. You do want to treat people who need narcotics. There's no doubt about it. On the other hand, you don't want to treat people with narcotics who are going to use them to get high. You know, and who are much more likely to be addicted. So you have to go through usual evaluation to decide those things.
Right. Now, what this says to me is what huge profits these drug companies must have in order to be able to absorb a $600 million fine and not go out of business.
Well, the drug is $1 billion to $2 billion a year drug. I mean, that's what the drug is. The drug is a huge drug. In 2004, they sold $1.3 billion of OxyContin in 2004. So right now, I mean, you know, it's a huge seller because it has a function. But what they did was they didn't exactly lean. They encouraged physicians to use the drug in a more common way. And then the drug all of a sudden started, the way that it's used and abused is it's pummeled down and then it's snorted and it gives the same high as heroin that's injected.
You would wonder whether this kind of huge fine would have any effects that you would hope it would have.
Well, it's a lot of money. I think $634.5 million is a lot of money. The real issue is that physicians are now much more aware. The feds are now more aware. And so are patients, and I think the use of narcotics is warranted in people who need them. They just have to be monitored on a regular basis safely.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. That's 800-462-7413. Zorba, we welcome a listener now in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I need to get Dr. Zorba's opinion on Ambien. I cannot sleep without taking Ambien, and I've tried the butterfly. I've tried all the others, and it seems
the butterfly.
That's what my granddaughter calls it, Nana. Get the butterfly.
Sure.
It seems like it almost has to just turn my brain off, like click. And the others don't seem to do that, like Ambien. And I cannot make myself go to sleep. So then, after about 6 hours, I wake up. And I can't go back to sleep. And if I do, I have horrible nightmares. So tell me what's going on in the brain.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's going on in the brain, there are a bunch of things. First of all, you may only need 6 hours of sleep. Back 10, 20 years ago, how much sleep did you get?
I could go on 4 hours easily.
Well, that's it. So you could go on 4 hours of sleep. You do not need as much sleep as I do.
Mm-hmm.
I need 8 to 9 hours of sleep. My wife needs about 5 to 6 hours of sleep, and it's always been that way. So first of all, it is an unrealistic expectation that you are going to get 8 or 9 hours of sleep. It's not going to happen. It's not your body. So, I would change your expectation. If you could go on 4, I would look at 6. What time do you go to sleep at night?
Some days my work day is longer than others.
Mm-hmm.
Some days I have to stay awake until like 11.
Okay.
And,
what time do you have to get up in the morning?
Whenever the Ambien cuts off.
That's when you have to get up in the morning and the Ambien cuts off. What time do you have to go to work?
Well, I'm self-employed. I have to make my own rules and regulations.
Okay, so let me tell you one of the recommendations. I'd like to give you some recommendations of what we call sleep hygiene.
Mm-hmm.
Sleep hygiene is a regular bedtime that you go to sleep and a regular time that you get up. There are two things that are an issue here. You make sure the bed is comfortable,
mm-hmm.
that you only use the bed for sleeping or relations. You don't use the bed, for instance, for reading a book unless you're going to read for 5 to 10 minutes before you go to sleep. And you do not watch television in bed because TV actually is enervating and stimulating. So you don't go to sleep with television. Mm-hmm. That's one of the best ways to keep yourself awake is to keep the television on when you go to sleep at night and then fall asleep. You don't do that. Make sure that the windows are darkened, you know, so in the morning, right. if it's early in the morning, you're not awakened, and that the room is cool enough and that the covers are comfortable and they're not heavy. Those are all the simple things. Now, from a bedtime point of view, decide when you have to wake up and count back 6 hours, and that's the time you go to sleep, and make it the same every day.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have to do is some days you have to go to sleep at 10, and other days you go to sleep at 1. That's a sure way towards insomnia, and a sure way. You want your clock to be extremely regular. And the more you regulate the sleep time and the wake time, the better off you are. And then when you wake up in the morning, you get out of bed. Because the nightmares are a reverie. They're very slight, a light sleep, and they lead to this REM sleep that can be very disturbing. And so you wake up in the morning, what you do is you get out of bed, and you get out of bed. And that's it. And your sleep will be better. And if you want to stay in the Ambien, you can. There are a lot of people who stay in Ambien. There are physicians that say, as I do, I don't prescribe it on a regular basis, but there are a lot of people who take it on a regular basis. So you're not going to sleep more than 6 hours. That's the issue.
After a while, it still has the same effects.
For some people, it'll have the same amount of sleep effects. And for other people, after 5 to 7 days or 2 weeks, it doesn't work as well. But for you, it sounds like it's giving you 6 hours. That's what you're going to get. Butterfly, rhinoceros, you know, the sheep on TV, the Serta mattress.
Yeah, all those, right. Mm-hmm. They don't work.
That's right. Regular time that you go to sleep as much as you can every night, as much as you can.
Yeah, and we appreciate your calling. Good luck to you. 800-462-7413, the toll-free number. Zorba, let's get to our MythBuster now. Today's myth deals with snakes or snake bites. It's long been thought that if you're bitten by a snake, that one of your friends, a real close friend, should suck out the poison. Will this really help treat a snake bite?
Can you imagine sucking out the poison? You know, you're bit by a snake. I mean, I picture
it. But you hear that all the time. If there's another person there, hurry up, suck the poison out.
It comes from the Western, you know, the Western movies.
Yeah, right,
John
right.
Wayne, quick, suck out the poison.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that is not the best advice. The best advice is not sucking out the poison. First of all, if you're bit in the middle of the woods and you're nowhere near emergency treatment,
right,
that's one issue. We're going to put that off to the side. Most people, when they're bit by a snake, are actually within 30 minutes to 2 hours away from emergency care, and that's the most important thing. The most important thing with a snake bite is the antidote. And it's the antivenom, which is the antidote. And getting to a site where you have emergency care is the most important thing you can do.
If it's on an arm, do you like do a tourniquet?
Tourniquet on the arm, but you can't totally. If you do a tourniquet on the arm, you can't totally take the blood flow away from the arm, or the arm will fall off. Basically, you stop the blood.
Yeah.
But putting on a tourniquet and taking it off periodically, putting it on and taking it off periodically, can work. But basically, sucking it out really doesn't do anything. It can cause nerve damage, damage to the blood vessels. Basically, as the antivenom is then pushing through the skin, and it's really not what you want. What you want to do is you want to wrap the body part in a comfortable wrap, and you want to keep it rather below the heart, not above the heart. So basically, the wounded part below the heart is going to make it much more likely that there's going to be circulation that will get into the heart, and you don't want to run. Anything to increase the circulation is what you don't want to do.
Okay.
So you want to be quiet, you want to lay down, you want the part below the heart, and you want somebody else to get you out.
So now what if you are in an isolated situation?
I don't think there's any evidence from what I read that sucking out the venom actually does anything. It actually just gets absorbed into the body.
So then you're kind of SOL.
Well, you could think that, but let's look at the number of snake deaths in America last year.
Yeah.
10.
10?
That's it. Now let's look at the number one venom death in America. Guess what that is? Venom death. It's not from a snake.
Venom death. Rabies?
Wasps, bees, and hornets. And there are about 500.
Yeah.
So roughly, your chances of dying are roughly about 100 times greater from a wasp, a bee, and a hornet than you are
from a snake.
There are a lot of snake bites, but there are very, very few snake deaths in the country. So it's an extraordinarily rare event.
So this MythBuster is really a kind of a useless thing to do.
I think anyone in New York City knows you suck out the poison from that. But if they get bit by a wasp, they don't know that they need adrenaline. If they're starting to be short of breath.
Yeah.
And actually, that's what we should do. You should think of the adrenaline venom bite as the hornet bite. But yeah, MythBusters, suck out the venom and wrong.
Got it. Do you have a myth for us? Well, we'll try to bust it or prove it right. Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413. To a listener now, Zorba in Auburn, Alabama. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
I have been diagnosed with high blood pressure, asthma, and 2 years ago with psoriatic arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
The problem comes in because I'm on methotrexate and Enbrel. Every spring or right after Christmas in the February time frame, I seem to come down with whatever chronic upper respiratory thing is going around. When I come down with this, I have to go off all of my medication for the arthritis, which creates a tremendous problem for me. I then, you know, never really get in full control. And I just wondered if there's anything I can do to cut down the possibility of getting the upper respiratory infection. You know, I try to take my asthma medicine as regularly as possible. I check my peak flows. I go to a PharmD who helps me monitor my blood pressure and my asthma. And I try to wash my hands. Nothing really seems to do the trick. Is there anything else you can think of that I could try?
Well, you know, the issue, of course, with asthma is it makes you much more likely not to get a virus, but when you get a virus, the virus is much more likely to affect you adversely. I might have the sniffles or, you know, I feel a little congestion and I cough a little bit and you'll wheeze and have trouble breathing and it becomes a very different issue. You know, the treatment of asthma is clear. We maximize the use of steroids, the benign steroids that we can, which are inhaled steroids. You're on Advair, is that what you're on? Is that one of the drugs?
Yes.
Advair, which is a combination steroid and something called a beta agonist, and it's really the best. It's clearly, head and shoulders, the best drug on the market, for asthma. And, following things, like you said, your peak flow to see how much air you can sort of breathe out of your body to make sure, you know, that you're not wheezing. I mean, it sounds like you're doing the right stuff. Now, are you around children all the time?
Yes, in a way. I have grandchildren who live only a couple of miles away from me.
Uh-huh. You know, and they're how old?
6 and 8 right now.
See, the problem is, and I always joke about it, you know, stop hugging the kids and when they come in, you know, stay away from them, which of course
you can't do that,
grandma. But the reality is they're the ones that are probably bringing these viruses into you. That's what's happening. Because they get sick and they get viruses all the time. And then you've got this, you know, vehicle for the virus called a child. And the child is the vehicle for the infection. And so the child brings the infection into your house. And one of the things to do is when they're sick, if you can't stay away with them, take a soapless cleanser such as Purell and wash your hands a lot when you're around them, because often the way the viruses are transferred are through intimate contact or scratching your nose. And intimate contact means, you know, you're in close contact like you are with your grandchildren and you're hugging them. And if they're sick and they have congestion, they're probably the ones that are bringing you that infector. And that's when you have to be particularly careful. And what I would do is if you're going to see them during that time, say, you know, if you're sick kids, you know, I'm going to see you, but I'm not going to hug you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard to do. But if you do that, you might cut down on these infections by 50%.
Okay.
You know, that might be it. And you say, hey, you have a cold. I want to see you and I want to be in the house, but I'm not going to hug you. And that's what you do. And it's very, very hard to do, but that may help you. And I think that would be the way I would go. You've got a PharmD, which is great, helping you make sure that you're on optimal medication. So your goal is not to get infected. And they're most likely the ones that are doing it.
Well, thank
that's what
you
I would
very
recommend.
Much.
Good luck.
Appreciate the
All
call.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Zorba, before we go, let's take a quick question from, we'll call him John in Buffalo, New York. John heard us chatting about the effects of marijuana recently. He admits to smoking a little bit of marijuana now and then and would like to know if the smoke is as dangerous to his lungs and body as cigarette smoke.
And the answer happens to be yes. And this is a question that has come up kind of numerous times about marijuana smoke. There are a couple of issues here. First of all, it's carbon monoxide that seems to be one of the big issues with smoking, no matter what you smoke. When you smoke marijuana, you hold it in your lungs for a long period of time. So it's taking a huge deep breath, the same as you would do with tobacco. You don't hold it in your lungs nearly as much. And the estimation is that if you get stoned mm-hmm. once a day, that it's probably equivalent to smoking anywhere between 2 to 3 cigarettes during that day.
Oh.
So you're at risk for the same factors, basically, as if you were in passive smoke. If you're a daily toker, you have the same risk probably once a day, even once a day, probably the same risk as passive smoking. Yeah. So the answer is yes, it does affect
you. 2 or 3 cigarettes a day is a risky procedure.
Oh, absolutely. It's a risky behavior. And so, you know, the idea that tobacco is bad and marijuana is safe is not the case. There's carbon monoxide, there's particulate matter, and there are other things that lead to heart attacks and stroke and lung cancer undoubtedly in the same amount. But the real issue is it is not benign from your cardiac point of view and from your lung point of view. It is a risk factor, just like smoking cigarettes.
We take all
for John and all the other Johns out there.
We take all of your questions here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health, even the ones dealing with illegal activities. So keep them coming. Just send them along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Zorba, we'll see you next week.
A pleasure, Tom.
For a copy of this week's recipe and all things Zorba, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
And don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.